Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Molasses Manifesto.
You ever look back and maybe try to put yourself in the victim's position of just being in the wrong place at the wrong time?
Well, there's nothing I can do about it. I can't say I really thought of it.
What about when the guy came out of the shank?
I knew that I was guilty, and you see, I wasn't really an innocent victim. I suppose that if I wasn't who I was, it wouldn't have happened. Take it, I guess, as best as you could. It's like nothing happened, you know. Not that type of person has got to hide or something. Hide a little bit.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got it.
And now the need for a story, if not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Episode 20. In the end, everyone sells their story. Act 1. Good housekeeping.
You mentioned that your mother had sold some sort of lurid story to some publication. I am the mother of the Son of Sam.
No, she sold a sympathetic story, that was a Good Housekeeping magazine. It came out, it was almost a 12-page, full-page article. It was an enormous article, And she had given the whole story. It was in a Good Housekeeping magazine, I think, for some time in 1978. Maybe March 78, or April 78. And it was just a soft story. One of these, begging for sympathy things. And it was just the way she presented herself to me, She wanted to exonerate herself of all guilt in that article. I think that's pretty clear. She said how sick I was, how I started to have this crazy behavior, or erratic behavior. It isn't true. This is what she pictures at home like.
In 1978, David Berkowitz's birth mother, Betty Falco, did an exclusive interview with Good Housekeeping magazine. An interview she was no doubt paid for. And David was none too pleased about it. Of course, David had always had conflicted feelings about Betty. Ever since the age of 5, when he was told that she had died giving birth to him. A death he felt personally responsible for. Right up until the moment when, at the age of 22, he had found out she was very much alive. He had been so conflicted, in fact, upon meeting her, that he began his murder spree shortly after. Trouble with her doing the Good Housekeeping article was, for David, that while he wanted nothing more than to lay the blame squarely at her feet, he simultaneously felt that she, personally, really didn't have anything to do with it, and therefore didn't really know anything about it. To his point, he had in fact only met her a few years before he was sent to prison for life.
He didn't pretend that she raised you or got to know you at all?
Yeah, she did.
She did.
Yeah. But that wasn't the case. We don't know each other at all.
Betty Falco knew no more than anyone else about the Son of Sam, other than what she saw on TV and maybe read in newspapers, if she even read at all. No idea that it was her biological child who was terrorizing New York City for 13 months as the son of Sam.
So according to Jack and David, Betty didn't really know much about the crimes, but that hadn't stopped her from sharing and selling her story. Because, as it turns out, Betty wasn't only working with Good Housekeeping, she was also working with Lawrence Klausner, who David was also mad at, due to the fact that he was writing a book about the crimes without David's input, which seems to be David's real issue with all this stuff. But David had always been endlessly judgmental of Betty, not only for the way in which she had handled the events surrounding his birth, but also for the way she had treated the men in her life. Men he felt she was using for financial gain. And now, as he saw it, he was just another man she was trying to take advantage of, and that infuriated him. All this added up to the fact that David felt Betty had no business talking about the murders, despite the fact that he said she was more or less responsible for them.
I didn't find out until about 2 months ago, or maybe a month ago, she was actually working on a book. I heard rumors, you know. She was working with Klausner, but I didn't know that for sure. And I found out, and then I realized that just as she tried to use these men, you see, to mooch off to somehow hope they give her some money, what she did for me. So what she is, I don't know how much she got for it, and it's not my business. I don't care anymore, really, because I don't communicate with her much. Since she did all behind my back, you know. How does she know anything about me? She really doesn't know anything about me at all, you know. But it sounds authentic, and she acts like she knows what she's talking about, you know what I mean?
Has she ever made any effort to visit you here?
Yeah, she came up in Marcy, you know, but it was one of these, it's the same thing, you know. She came up in Marcy, right? Now, here I am. I'm the guy that committed the crimes, right? I'm the criminal, the killer. She walks in the door, starts apologizing all over again, you know? I'm sorry, Richie, it's all my fault, da, da, da. You know? Oh, my God. Here we go again, you know? They call me Richie, in case you're interested, you know? That's what they call. I don't like that name at all.
An apple not fell far from the tree. Mother and son duke it out for attention.
What made me angry was when my biological mother wrote me after I'd been in prison for a while. She said, "Oh, Richie, if only I didn't, you know, give you, you know, if I raised you, things would have been different." I didn't say anything. I never responded to that, but I was very upset. Because I really would have been a wreck. If I'd been raised by her, I see what would have happened, you know. I don't see how these actions that I've, the crimes that I committed are in relation to my adopted parents. In fact, I wish there was some way I could have, even when I was out there committing the crimes, I wish there was some way my father could never ever find out about this, but I saw that I needed capture and punishment, you know, after a period of time.
If David Berkowitz ever loved anyone, it was his adoptive mother, who did everything possible to earn his trust and love. She was a wonderful woman, and any child, adoptive or biological, would have been lucky to have had Pearl Berkowitz as their mom.
Jack asked David if Betty's daughter, David's half-sister Rosalind, ever sold her story to anyone.
Your sister never made any effort to capitalize on it.
Oh, no, well, not directly. She has, because she's working with my mother, and she worked with the Good Housekeeping article, you know, and things. She's just not as, they're not open about it. I see what's happening, you know. They never told me what they're doing. Someone else thinks.
But David's birth mother, Betty, and his half-sister Rosalind weren't the only ones that sold their association with him. His high school sweetheart, Iris Gerhardt, did too.
There was this girl, Iris Gerhardt, the one I used to go with. I used to write her from Korea, and I wrote her about 15 letters, I'd say, lengthy letters. She sold them to New York Post for $500, and they printed almost every one of them on the front pages.
She was the one who went out with the other guy?
Yeah,
I thought that was... But those were just letters from Korea or something.
They were kind of crazy in themselves, because that was when I was used to get high a lot. You know, just smoke with all the guys. And we used to write kind of what you call freaky letters to shock everybody, you know? And it gave the impression somehow to the papers brought it out that I was losing my mind or something.
Everyone he had known or had anything to do with had in the end betrayed him. So this was another way of justifying in his mind this volcanic hatred he had come to feel for society at large. It was imagined, I mean, certainly Pearl Berkowitz did not betray him. Right to the end, Nat Berkowitz stuck by him and tried to support him. There were probably a few other people that he walked away from and dismissed because he was incapable of a loving or meaningful or trusting friendship or love, but a lot of the people did.
Posner offered my father $50,000 to cooperate. My father said no.
In the mad dash scramble to profit off a newfound personal association with a famous serial killer, there seems to be one notable exception. David Berkowitz's adoptive father, Nat, with whom David, ironically, was never close. Which is doubly impressive when you take into account that Nat, despite being a very hard worker his entire life, never had much money.
As far as I know, his adoptive father never approached or agreed when approached to sell his story to any of the publications, which at that time, the man could have written his own book and possibly made a good deal of money because of all the interest. Everything we know about his adoptive father and mother is that they were very caring and thoughtful and intelligent people who tried their best to support the child they had adopted. And that continued even after these murders, to the point that his father tried to be as supportive as possible to the child he had come to know as his son.
Nat Berkowitz, until the day he died, refused to condemn his son, even after he was revealed to be a murderer of the young. Out of some kind of sense of fatherly duty, I can only guess, but that's what he did. Nat never made excuses or tried to minimize what David did. He just stood by his son and continued to give him support in the way he felt a father should. But it wasn't just Nat that stood by David. There was also someone else.
I'm concerned that maybe your girlfriend is being your girlfriend is so she can get a leg up and sell a story to somebody or something.
Oh, I used to think of that, but she hasn't. Oh, she's not that way. If you meet her, you see that she couldn't. She wouldn't know how to do this.
Wait, what? David Berkowitz had a girlfriend? Like a for real girlfriend? Apparently he did. For a time.
Like many of these notorious murderers and rapists, David, once he was in prison, was contacted by a female pen pal who became his girlfriend while he was in Attica, visited him regularly. I saw her on one occasion from a distance. I never spoke with her. She had very dark hair, I think dyed black hair, probably, and was exactly the kind of relationship that he maybe could appreciate because it could never be consummated. I don't know if they have stayed in touch. I suspect that there were a lot of women who were writing him at that time, and I suspect that, like other rapists and murderers I have known of and known behind bars, he had a series of such girlfriends, pen pals.
Jack asked David if he ever asked his girlfriend why she contacted him.
Did you ever ask her why?
Oh, often, right. At first, when our relationship started, I even tried to discourage her because she didn't seem to have a realistic attitude, promising me that she'll wait for me to get until I get out and all these things. And I told her time and time again, I was the more realistic one, and I told her that all these things are very doubtful, that chances are this won't work out, and I had the idea that she'd probably get tired of coming up here after a while. That last part I was wrong about. She doesn't seem to be tired of it yet. But I try to tell her to be realistic, you know.
Why did she say that she used to have this contact with you?
That's not clear. I guess she just loves me. She sees in me a kindred spirit or something.
Has she felt the same kind of anger? Do you talk
sure
about
she
that?
Has, but hers is turned inward. She's self-destructive.
Self-destructive in what way? Does she drink too much?
Or? No, she eats too much. She's overweight. And her hang-up, her anger is with herself. She can't seem to face that. And she something happens that's frustrating, or she finds her life unfulfilling, and she'll turn it inward, blame it on herself, and overeat, just compounding the problem. She needs to find somebody to be with and spend her time with, share her life with, because she's almost 30 years old. But she can't, and every time she tries, she makes a half-hearted attempt. She feels frustrated, and she overeats, just making it even more difficult the next time to succeed. It's that's deadly cycle, you know, of self-destructiveness, gradual over a period of time.
How often does she come up?
Once a month. She writes a few times a week. I write her a few times a week. We've got a pretty close relationship to a degree. She takes the prison bus.
How long does she stay?
Today.
You don't have any ideas of someday maybe getting married in prison or something?
She wants that. She keeps bugging me about it. I don't really want to go through with that. I don't want to get married to her now, especially since I have no money or anything to support her. She doesn't work or anything.
How long is she going to come after
you? Well, she started to visit me. She visited me the first time when I was in Marcy. And she's been up here about 20-something times, 25 times.
When did she first write?
And when I was, just after I got arrested, about a month after I got arrested.
After taking the lives of six young people that will, because of him, never get married, have children, or pursue lives and careers of their own, David Berkowitz was, as a result, in prison, negotiating press coverage, and entertaining a marriage proposal. Act 2, How Do We Cover This? As David Berkowitz's crimes pass from things of myth and legend into the pages of history via books, magazine, and newspaper articles, the snake continued to eat its tail as David chimes in on how he thinks all this should be covered. And he does this by looking at the ways in which other infamous murders in the past were treated.
Do you see any parallels between your case and the way that Charles Manson's case was commercially exploited?
Definitely. Almost identical.
The flagrant and almost unconscious way these guys reveal their narcissism is through comparisons to one another. These guys being mass murderers and serial killers who have gained notoriety and been captured and taken alive and are talking to psychiatrists and media from the comfort of their prison cells, where they'll never have to make another decision on their own in life that they don't choose to make. And they want to be known as the ultimate Jack the Ripper of their particular era. Whether or not their crimes are identically patterned after one another or infamous killers throughout history that we know of, probably the most notorious being Jack the Ripper. They want to be known as having done something that nobody else did. They bring a personal signature to their criminology. We haven't talked about the Silence of the Lambs, Dr. Hannibal Lecter, but they all think of themselves as an evil genius monster.
Berkowitz continues to make the comparison between himself and Manson, who was probably the most infamous murderer in the years leading up to Berkowitz's crimes. despite never having ever killed anyone himself.
The victims, okay, in that particular, in his case, the victims were wealthy. You know, they were all very wealthy, but that's a rare exception. Most people that are full victims of violent crimes are just the average citizens, you see. So they, you know, as far as compensation, the survivors and their families, that's different. That's the only thing that's different about the cases. Otherwise, the sensationalism and everything else is almost identical. You know, the newspapers and so forth, building up emotionalism, all these books, movies written, written about it, exploiting everything. It's callous and it's degrading. It's degrading for everybody that died in all these things, you see, because nothing is learned or gained, and the victims are still victims. They haven't received any compensation or support, and in fact, they're even worse off because with all this movie coming out, it reopens their wounds. You know what I mean? And it puts them through more mental torment and anguish as they have to try to recall all the grisly details which are thrown in front of them as the newspapers advertise the movies.
I don't know how you take the moral high ground after viciously gunning down scores of young people, but still, David finds a way. And certainly, I am by no means saying that the intentions of all who covered the crimes were sterling, but it's almost as if it's repulsive to him to see what he did reflected back at him. And in doing so, blames the reflection. But don't worry, he has a plan to confront the media head on.
I think I really have a reasonable idea here that something should be done. I don't think the public should take this stuff from these multi-million dollar film industries and book companies who exploit violent tragedy after violent tragedy. And I think the victims or the potential victims should unite together and try to change something, because we don't know who's going to be the next victim of a violent crime, you see.
Sounds great. But really, I see it as a way of getting back at people who are telling the story without him. But of course, he can't come out and say that. That's not part of his platform. The good he can do, the import he has in the problem solving, etc., form the fundamental pillars of Berkowitz's one-man plan to change America for the better.
In the United States alone, I think there are over 18,000 murders a year, and God knows how many assaults and attempted assaults, how many people are wounded, injured, you know. The amount of victims of violent crime every year in the United States, it goes up into the millions, of, you know. Millions of people handicapped for life, crippled for life, others killed, you know. And while, you know, I can see the people's point of demanding stiffer prison sentences and the reinstitution of the death penalty, still, I feel the entertainment industry is also guilty, because they by portraying the films and things the way they do, it shows that they condone it, you see.
David Berkowitz takes on Hollywood.
Like in my case, okay, 6 people died. Now this was a horrifying tragedy, right? The damage is irreversible. But a movie that will come out, which is just going to be a blockbuster movie aimed at entertainment, what this movie will do, in essence, is just really trample over the graves of the victims. Because you can't say to the families that survived, right, that are mourning now, that this was entertaining, that the death of their son or daughter was entertaining, you see. But this movie is not going to teach anybody anything, you know? It's not going to educate anybody about anything. Rather, it's going to desensitize the whole thing. The movie will cause the general public in time to just simply forget about the victims, you know? The victims, well, what happened is the deaths of these victims won't be as important as it once was, you know? Won't outrage the public as their deaths once did, and eventually it will all be forgotten about and covered over by the entertainment industry as just be commercial exploitation by the entertainment industry, profiteering over the deaths of these people with nothing gained or learned. In fact, more harm will be done in the long run because it might edge somebody else on.
Self-crowned protector, David Berkowitz is now, quote-unquote, defending the honor and reputation of the very people he killed. by going to war with the entertainment industry.
It'll show the impressionistic members of society, like the, you know, young teenagers, young children, that things like this are condoned. And that murder, you see, the way I did it, by expressing my frustrations outwardly, is an acceptable form of doing expression, you know what I mean?
And he's saying this because he himself, according to him, was inspired and encouraged by films he saw depicting violent attacks in the years before his murders. Films such as The Deadly Tower, released in the fall of 1975, about Charles Whitman, and Taxi Driver, released in the winter of 76, based on fictional character Travis Bickle. So he's saying, don't make a movie about me. A movie which will no doubt be a blockbuster and will make me look so good that some kid out there will model themselves after me.
You see, what I did was wrong, right? Now, I guess the courts tried to set an example by sending me to 13 consecutive life terms in prison. Okay, I agree, yes, I deserve it. But if they want to teach anybody anything, if they want to set an example, then by making a movie of entertainment, you see, would teach these young people who they tried to, like, you know, show, you see what that man did, see how evil he is now, don't ever do what he did because he's going to prison for the rest of his life. Yet, a couple, you know, in a short time, while I'm still in their minds, you know, they then see a Son of Sam movie and everything's portrayed as exciting and glamorous and thrilling, you see.
Son of Sam the movie. There were already books on the crimes, currently in the works, and there had been, from the very start, lots of articles as well as television and radio coverage. Now Berkowitz's mind was bent toward film, The Final Frontier.
So, as far as, like, the law is concerned, or the society, or the state officials, the courts, their parents, as far as all these adults and so forth are concerned, anything they tried to teach their children about how crime doesn't pay or how bad crime is was self-defeating when they let their kids 2 years later go to the movie and see the movie, and then they'll say, well, the kids will get the impression, well, that wasn't that bad. In fact, that was really scary and fun to watch, you know. If the parents tried to make an impact on the children to teach them that the crimes are evil, they just destroyed that attempt at teaching them by allowing the children to view something like this, you see.
So David is officially against a movie being made about him, due to the fact that a film about him would no doubt be so powerful that it would undermine everything we've ever taught our children not to do. Jack asks Berkowitz how crimes like his should be covered then, if at all.
Where do you find a line that runs between responsibility and censorship?
Well, that's something for, like, when I had the suggestion of a state media review board, that's something for them to really iron out, because I can't put it all down on paper, and I would hope that various professionals, you see, would get together and try to draw a line so where that movies wouldn't be banned or something, but if something is really outrageous, if something is dangerous, you see, that it could possibly be worked out between the publisher and this, like, review committee that would be established to tone things down or gear things so, you know, it wouldn't be as glamorous or something. They wouldn't be as desensitizing, you know, to the victims and so forth. You know, you can't hide the fact of violence from people because it's a fact of life, you see. That means millions of people fall victim to violent crime every year, so you can't. You don't ignore it, but at the same time, you don't want to glamorize it and encourage it, you see.
Jack asks David about people who want to see him dead.
How do you feel about people who react to you like stringing him up by the toes?
I have nothing against them. I understand their point of view. They seem in me as having no value, as having transgressed the laws of society, committed horrendous crimes, and, you know, their sense of justice is pretty clear-cut.
Act 3, Jack's Articles.
To understand a disease, you have to be able to put aside your fear of that disease. Fear is an emotion even more powerful than anger, probably. And arguably, anger can reach the point of becoming a disease that clouds our judgment. The best way to approach these people is as objectively as we possibly can, without losing the sense of legitimate outrage, but maybe focusing that outrage some way in a preventive approach. I was trying to get at meanings in a way that I could express in layman's terms instead of the psychiatric, you know, what we call, you know, psychobabble that is often used in the clinical reports on these guys. A way that maybe a parent could read his story as I presented it and see something in a child who may be headed for prison later or for violence, up to and including particularly murder.
Jack wanted, as Berkowitz did, for something even slightly positive to be wrung from any of this, if at all possible. Although I think Jack wanted it for an altogether different reason than Berkowitz did.
I think, and I thought about it long and hard, this thing has been, you know, it's with me just about everywhere I go since we started this thing. I do think that that I can put together these articles, or, you know, an article or some articles out of this series of interviews that will be something positive.
Right.
And it's just going to take time, you know. You're going to have to get people to get close enough to it to learn something about it.
Well, with this guy Bundy and this guy Gacy, you know, it's hard. So that's been in the news so much lately. And Bianchi, from what's been in your paper, you know, people see, I guess, a guy like me is, you know, such an extremely, like some type of Hitler, you know, or a Hess. Looking at all the damage these other guys did, you know, pile with my case, the damage I did, it's awful hard for people to look, you know, open-mindedly at anything I'm saying.
He may be right about that.
Yeah. Oh, last night, for example, I was listening to the Rochester, New York, the talk show, WHAM. You know the show, I mean. And they had he started out the argument, this guy Jack, forgot his name. Something like that, yeah. He started off the argument about the death penalty. This generated calls from the people of Rochester, and of course my name was brought up. Probably as a result of the recent article. You know, one woman, only one woman called up about it. She says, well, this guy's got some nerve. I know she was talking about the article, even though she didn't refer to it. She said, well, this guy's got some nerve trying to help society. You know, who does he think he is? And Jack Jones says, well, maybe he's trying to give people a better image of himself. And then they didn't say much. He says, well, I think the death penalty should be brought back. You know, she was seemed to be very angry, you know. And he said, well, if Berkowitz wants to help society, the best thing for him to do is just stay in prison and it'll help society. You know what I mean? It was like sort of like a humorous thing. And that was it.
There are surviving families and there's a lot of pain. But putting guys like Berkowitz immediately into a gas chamber or electric chair is not going to do anything except possibly promote even more violence, because there's some evidence that murderers are more likely to murder in situations where they know that they're going to be executed, because their murders are a form of suicide that they don't quite have the courage to do to themselves. So they choose innocent targets in the hope of being killed and punished.
Berkowitz, in typical fashion, got angry at the female caller for suggesting he was of no benefit to society and should be summarily put to death.
Of course, I wish I was there so I can ask her, oh, well, what are you doing for society, you know? You see? People are condemned, well, why should he do? He has some nerve to try to do anything good for anybody. But yet, I wonder if this person was a person who was a Girl Scout master or something, or a gay first aid lectures, or worked for the Salvation Army, did anything civic-minded. You know, she might have been a very unhelpful person, except for her immediate family. So I would say to her, you know, you've got a lot of nerve too. You haven't done it. You know, you see all these activities, you can be volunteer services, you can become involved in, you never do, so can't find fault with me.
If you don't volunteer and make yourself of service to society, then you're in no position to find faults with David Berkowitz, which is, of course, a ridiculous notion. As Jack's articles began to run, the reaction was, unfortunately, not altogether positive.
I received a number of letters accusing me, even during that era, before the term liberal became used as an epithet, of being a pansy liberal who was more interested in coddling criminals and killers than in seeking justice for the victims.
I've also been getting strange phone calls.
Okay.
That's something I wanted to ask, whether, there's nobody you can think of, who might not want to see you come across as being a sane, rational person, and who's maybe trying to frighten me by giving these weird phone calls all hours of the day and night.
What?
Do you know of any?
Oh no, I don't know.
Might be?
No.
I wonder,
inmates have access to a phone.
I just wondered if maybe somebody on the outside might have contacted you one way or another.
No, I have not gotten anything on it.
Okay. It gets a little bit disturbing sometimes in the middle of the night.
Yeah. So how many letters did the hate letters did the paper get?
There was one crank letter, and there were another three or four which the editor of the publishing page said didn't even bother publishing. Because they were just too often too angry.
Mm.
It ain't going to happen overnight.
I know.
It's a long, slow process.
Yeah. Sometimes, I think, well, here I am wanting to help the people, and then you get this vicious, feedback. You wonder if it's even worth it,
David wonders, in a moment of doubt, after hearing of the treatment Jack was receiving, if any of it was even worth it.
I did receive a lot of hate mail and hateful, some downright threatening phone calls for daring to write about a monster like David Berkowitz. And the editors made the decision to publish my first story about him on the front page of the Sunday newspaper on a day that a famous Olympian had won an unprecedented 5 gold medals. And the David Berkowitz, mass murderer, serial killer story pushed down coverage of this amazing accomplishment by an American Olympic athlete. I didn't make that decision, but it did influence the editors enough, all of the hate mail that the paper received, that my later stories about Berkowitz didn't get quite near the placement in the newspaper as the first one did.
Act 4. Stabbed in the Neck. On July 11th, 1979, less than a full year before Jack and David sat down to conduct the interview around which this podcast is based, David was stabbed in the neck by a fellow inmate.
In 1979, he was stabbed in the neck by another prisoner while delivering hot water to this other prisoner's cell on the protective custody block where he was also being housed. He was one of the prisoners who would have been a target inside prison and general population because of the notoriety of his crime. And the fact that there would be other people serving life sentences who would have killed him simply to get fan mail as the guy who killed the Son of Sam.
Jack asked David about the attack.
What about the guy came out of the shank?
I knew that I was guilty, you see. I wasn't really an innocent victim. I suppose that if I wasn't who I was, it wouldn't have happened. Take it, guess as best as you could, it's like nothing happened, Not that type of person that's got to hide or something, hide a little bit.
For some reason, David Berkowitz took it rather well. In fact, He seemed almost pleased that it had happened.
He felt very good about having had been stabbed. It gave him cred inside the prison, among other things. Now he had a scar. He had a tattoo, the ultimate tattoo, that some other bad guy had done him the honor of trying to take him out. He walked with even more of a swagger after that.
Quote, "The attempt on my life is one of the best and most positive events of my recent past slash present. It didn't upset me in the least, but as a result, I have a more positive outlook on life. We all learn from our mistakes and misjudgments. It was for the better. Plus, the scar gives character to my face. It shows other inmates that I've been around. They see I've been through the ropes and also that I'm not a stool pigeon. But most of all, I now feel secure and that there is a sense of justice in the world. There is really a law of cause and effect. I've always wanted punishment, the punishment I deserve. I love being punished. So this was it. I've been trying to expiate my sins for so long. This just felt so good. It felt almost as if I was miraculously cleansed for a time being." End quote. 7 inches long, a half inch wide, and comprised approximately of 60 stitches, the scar that Berkowitz received from the attempt on his life ran from below his left jaw, under his chin, and around to the back of his neck. But it doesn't end there, as David, even in the case of his own stabbing, considers himself to be responsible. Quote, "There is something that no one knows. This 7-inch slash on my neck, I did it. I set myself up. I willed it and unconsciously wanted it. I needed it. Does this sound strange? Believe it or not, and I didn't realize this myself until several days after the attack, I unknowingly, but not quite unwittingly, transmitted message to my assailant that I would be better off dead. I hinted often that one day I was going to die in the joint because I had enemies. I actually implanted in this ruffian's mind that I should and must die. I must have also hinted that I had no fear of death, and now I have no doubt that he literally picked up on my death wish vibes. If it wasn't for my frequent talks about death and someone knocking me off, I don't think this would have happened." End quote. So David Berkowitz had a lot of feelings and crackpot, at best, theories about his own stabbing. But never once in his musings on the subject did he ever bring up the fact that he did this to Michelle Forman on Christmas Eve, 1975, when she was just 15 years old.
I don't know that he ever made the connection between his own attempt to murder an innocent human being and the arguably legitimate attack that another guy made on him while he was in prison.
David Berkowitz once again evades the unforgiving lens of scrutiny he readily applies with absolute enthusiasm to everyone else. Quote, "I really do want to be punished, yet I also don't want to be. I want to live, yet I want to die. Sometimes I feel guilty for what I've done. Other times, I feel good about it, and I want to live a little longer so I can gloat over my sins." End quote. Next time, on the final episode of Killer Tape, Season 1, David gets a movie, and as a result, joins a unique group of monsters.
Will they start making a movie about you, or whatever?
Well, they are going to start soon. In fact, they're writing it up now. Making their outlines. The movie deal was already approved in the court just last month, you see.
What about the movie?
This is sick, you know?
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D., and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt, Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.